Steve Homer, host of Culture City Radio, wishing you a very happy holiday to all the great music fans in Detroit and all over the world. Thank you, and happy holidays and a happy new year.
The odds of this Alaskan-born pitcher being selected to the Major League Baseball All-Star Game 6 times? 1 in 48 million. The odds of this fastballing philanthropist winning the World Series 3 times? 1 in 3 million. The odds of this man having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. Hi, I'm Kurt Schilling. Learn the signs of autism at autismspeaks.org. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
Computer Information Systems Certificate in Web Technologies and Design.
Love to design stuff and play on the internet? Henry Ford Community College offers a one-year certificate program in web technologies and design. Advanced HTML, computer art, web authoring tools, and web multimedia are a few of the courses offered.
Computer Information Systems Certificate in Web Technologies and Design.
The program is designed to prepare a student to take CIW Certificate Internet Webmaster exams.
For more information on CIW exams, log on to www.ciwcertified.com.
Drop by the HFCC counseling office or log on to the web at hfcc.edu.
Computer Information Systems Certificate in Web Technologies and Design.
This is Mr. White, and I'm offering you the opportunity to have as much fun as I do every Thursday at noon on the Blues Time. So tune in to 89.3, be happy as you can be, or get online and listen to the Blues Time, the world's greatest blues show on Thursday at noon. So get groovy.
This is WHFR, Dearborn.
Disclaimer: this show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our board of trustees, or students.
Earth, sky.
The next sunspot cycle after the current one could be delayed by 2 to 5 years at least, and perhaps longer. We have, or at the other extreme, it could mean that there may be no sunspots appearing at all for an extended period of time.
This is Earth Sky's Clear Voices for Science, and you're listening to astronomer Frank Hill of the U.S. National Solar Observatory. Dr. Hill led research that found something new under the sun, indications that sunspot activity might drop dramatically starting around the year 2019. Hill spoke more about the sunspot study with Earth Sky's Jorge Salazar.
What are the main findings of your study, which you co-authored, that is about jet streams below the surface of the sun and what that has to do with the solar cycle?
Well, we have been for 16 years now observing the inside of the sun using a technique called helioseismology. The sun is filled with sound waves, acoustic waves, that penetrate and travel all the way throughout the sun and are visible when they strike the surface of the sun from the inside, making the surface move up and down. By using this data, we can infer how the motions of the gas inside the sun are moving, and we have found that there is a jet stream which had been observed previously on the surface in 1981, that is very tightly timed to the solar cycle. When the jet stream moves, this jet stream is typically first appears at a high latitude on the sun near the solar poles, approximately 10 to 12 years before the start of the solar cycle, and it then moves first towards the poles and then down. Another branch appears and it moves down towards the equator. We should be seeing the poleward branch of this flow, which is also known as the torsional oscillation, for cycle 25, which is the next cycle of sunspots after the one we are in, which is cycle 24. We should have seen that flow back in 2008, and we still have not seen it. And so this leads us to believe that there is something different about cycle 25 than we have previously seen.
So would you mind maybe just to make these connections for us? There are these jet streams on the surface of the sun, and those are connected to the activity of sunspots, and then that is also connected to how hot the sun gets.
Yes, it is. Sunspots. When the sun has sunspots on it, the sun is a little bit brighter than when it does not. So if there is a lack of sunspots, then the sun is a little bit dimmer. And by a little bit, I mean a tenth of a percent. It's a very small percentage, a very small fraction.
Maybe just to dig into that question just a little bit more. What does this all mean?
Well, it could mean a range of things. It could mean that the next sunspot cycle after the current one could be delayed by 2 to 5 years at least, and perhaps longer. We have, or at the other extreme, it could mean that there may be no sunspots appearing at all for an extended period of time. That we may be entering what was a situation similar to the Maunder minimum, which was a period of 70 years or so from 1645 to 1715, where no visible sunspots or very few visible sunspots were observed. Those are just two extremes of the possibilities.
That minimum was associated with the Little Ice Age, I believe. Is that right?
It was, anecdotally. However, there are some indications that the connection with the Little Ice Age may not be quite as strong as some people claim. It partly depends on how you define the Little Ice Age. But in some measures, you can say the Little Ice Age can be thought to have occurred 100 to 300 years before the Maunder Minimum itself. So while part of it coincided with the Maunder Minimum, not all of it did. So it's not clear that there really was a cause and effect. It's definitely a very gray area, and of course we don't have very good data on it because it happened so long ago.
Now, would you tell us a little bit about the data that your team collected? What is the evidence to support these claims of a possible major drop in solar activity for the next solar cycle, starting, I believe, around 2013 or so?
Well, no, that's not quite correct. 2013 will actually see a maximum. We are talking that a maximum of the current solar cycle, which is number 24. What we're talking about is the next solar cycle, number 25, which should start, if things go right, in about 2019, 2020. What we are claiming is that it may not start in 2019, 2020, may be delayed for till 2025, of something of that nature, or even longer. We don't know. We cannot tell yet.
Yeah, thank you for clarifying that.
Sure. But the evidence is this. This torsional oscillation, this jet stream flow, which we are observing inside the sun as well with helioseismology, is very tightly correlated with the timing of the solar cycle. For instance, you may have heard of the long deep minimum that we just emerged from between cycles 23 and 24. That minimum was approximately one and a half years longer than what we usually experience. We found that the torsional oscillation, the jet stream, which migrates from high to low latitudes, was migrating at a much slower rate than it had in the past, and that it took about 1.5 years longer to reach the latitude at which sunspots begin to appear. And that made us realize that that observing this phenomenon could provide sort of a clock and sort of a future predictor for what would be happening for the overall solar cycle itself.
Now, how firm are these predictions of low solar activity starting around 2019, 2020?
Well, they are definitely based on our interpretation of the data that we have now. It is certainly possible that the sun will surprise us again, as it always, as it frequently does, and will quickly pick up activity in spite of what we are seeing now. There are two other indicators that the sunspot, that the solar cycle may be going into a different state that were also discussed in the course of our press conference. One is that coronal emissions, which the corona is the tenuous outer atmosphere of the sun, some light of a certain wavelength in the corona also tracks the magnetic flux, the sunspots, and traces them out. And it, too, shows a lack of the phenomena that we expect in advance of cycle 25. The other piece of evidence is that the sunspots themselves apparently are getting weaker in terms of their magnetic field strength, and they are getting brighter, so they are fading from view, and they have been since the middle of cycle 23 and now into this cycle 24 as well. If you extrapolate that effect, then sunspots will vanish also in the time frame of 2020 to 2025. So we have these three independent lines of observations, of evidence, all of which can be interpreted to mean that the solar cycle will either be greatly delayed or may be going into hibernation.
You've been listening to Frank Hill, Associate Director of the U.S. National Solar Observatory. To subscribe to this and other free science interview podcasts, visit the subscribe page at earthsky.org. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Support for the Freakonomics radio podcast comes from Intel, developing technology that creates new possibilities in industry, including healthcare, transportation, energy, retail, and education. More at intel.com/inside. Intel, sponsors of tomorrow. Support also comes from REI. Since 1938, REI has provided gear and advice to inspire, educate, and outfit for a lifetime of outdoor adventure and stewardship. Information in stores and at REI.com.
Yes, life was pretty good until I got a phone call from my broker.
That's Stephen Greenspan. He's an emeritus professor of psychology at the University of Connecticut.
Hi, Catherine.
Hey.
And this is Catherine Wells. She's one of the producers on our show. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, Stephen.
So you are here today with a story for us, yes?
Right, a story about Stephen Greenspan. He has an interesting specialty. He's an expert in what he calls social incompetence, which,
I have
you know,
some of that.
We all feel.
Yep.
What he means is he studies why people do dumb things.
Presumably that means why smart people do dumb things?
Right, that included.
And when he told you there that life was pretty good, what did he mean? What was so good exactly about his life?
Well, it was December 2008, and he had a book coming out called Annals of Gullibility. The other thing that seemed pretty good was his financial situation. About a year earlier, he had invested in a hedge fund that was doing pretty well, so he was getting nicely set up for retirement, too. So one day in December, he gets this first pre-release copy of the book, the Gullibility book, and 2 days later, his broker calls.
I said, "How are you?" He said, "Terrible. It's the worst day of my life." Now, this is a man who'd lost a son, so when he said it's the worst day of my life, that got my attention. And I said, "Why?" He said, "Well, Bernard Madoff just admitted he was running a Ponzi scheme."
Uh-oh.
And I responded, "Who is Bernard Madoff, and what's it have to do with me?"
So, Catherine, I think we can kind of smell where this is headed.
Right. This fantastic hedge fund that Greenspan had invested in turned out to be a feeder for Madoff's Ponzi scheme. And Greenspan had no idea. He didn't even remember having heard Madoff's name.
Oh, man. So the gullibility expert has been gulled.
Right. Gulled in a big, ironic way. He lost $400,000. Mm. Now, this was just about a third of his savings, so it wasn't the total end of the world. And he should get some money back eventually from settlements. But he's 70 now. He has two college-aged kids, and he'd really hope to be retired by now. And, you know, he certainly didn't want to be remembered in this way.
There was a columnist, a financial columnist in Canada, who in his blog wrote, "The first Greenspan Allen will be remembered as the economist who didn't see it coming, while the other Greenspan Stephen will be remembered as the psychologist who forgot to read his own book on gullibility."
Ouch, right?
Poor guy. Yeah.
I mean, it's ironic because Greenspan's own research shows that even the smartest people can be duped.
I mean, a good example of that would be Sir Isaac Newton, the greatest scientist of all time. who lost over $1 million in modern dollars in the South Sea bubble. And so he wrote, "I can calculate the orbit of heavenly bodies, but I cannot fathom the madness of men."
In reference to losing this money?
In reference to his own foolishness in putting all of his fortune at risk in something that he wasn't really, in spite of his incredible brilliance, able to really understand or adequately calculate the risk of.
So in a way, joined kind of an elite club of brilliant, informed, educated people who can be fooled.
I joined the human race, basically. Like Sir Isaac Newton in the South Sea Bubble, I knew nothing about Madoff and just basically went along with the crowd. And that's powerful. We tend to take our cues from other people, especially in situations where we don't quite know what to do.
So it may no longer surprise us to learn that smart people sometimes make dumb decisions.
Right. It's like Greenspan says. It's the instinct to go along with the crowd and to take our cues from other people. And that's really what today's show is about.
Right. And I want to talk about something else Greenspan said, an even more elemental issue, which is how we make decisions about a risk that we just aren't equipped to calculate. But here's the thing. If it can't be calculated, then maybe it's not exactly a risk. About 100 years ago, the economist Frank Knight argued that risk and uncertainty are nearly identical, but for one key difference. Risk can be measured. Uncertainty, by its nature, cannot. But what happens when you can't tell the two of them apart?
From WNYC and APM American Public Media, this is Freakonomics Radio. Today, the truth is out there, isn't it? Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
So Stephen Greenspan, the gullibility expert, loses a third of his life savings in what turns out to be a Ponzi scheme. Now, even if you feel sympathetic toward him, you might say, hey, you know, he's just one person. Bad things happen to people every day. At least the world didn't end. But what if we were worried about something that might end the world? No, I'm not talking about an attack by alien nations. Not yet, at least. That'll come later in the program. I'm talking about climate change. How are people like you and me supposed to calculate the threats from something like climate change? There's so much complexity, so much uncertainty. So most of us do what Stephen Greenspan did when he was looking to invest. We take our cues from other people.
It's not a question of debate. It's like gravity. It exists.
The reason that you know you're right is that you know things they don't know. And because they don't even have that baseline of knowledge to chat with you, they can't even understand where you're coming from. And that's exactly how I feel talking to people who believe this global warming crap.
The science is solid, according to a vast majority of researchers, with hotter temperatures, melting glaciers, and rising sea level providing the proof.
When the University of Madison, Wisconsin comes out with their definitive study, do I believe that? No. Do I believe scientists? No, they've lied to us about global warming. Who do you believe?
Who do you believe? That was Glenn Beck, by the way. Before him, from the top, you heard Al Gore and then Rush Limbaugh and an ABC World News report. When it comes to something like climate change, as fraught as it is with risk and uncertainty and emotion, who do you believe? And, more important, why?
You know, my personal perception is that I don't know enough about it, believe it or not. This is an issue that I think...
Wait, could you just say that again so everyone in the world can hear an honest response? Like, it's so rare for some version of I'm not quite sure, I don't know. So, sorry, say it again and then proceed.
What I was saying, I'm not sure exactly what I believe on it in terms of the risk perceptions of climate change. It's something that I don't think I am personally educated on enough to have a really firm opinion about that.
That was Ellen Peters. She teaches in the psychology department at Ohio State University. She is part of a research group called the Cultural Cognition Project. They look at how the public feels about certain hot-button issues like nuclear power and gun control, and then they try to figure out how much those views are shaped by people's cultural values. That is, not empirical evidence, but people's what they call cultural cognition. So they recently did a study on climate change. How was it, they wanted to know, that the vast majority of scientists think the Earth is getting warmer because of human activity, but only about half the general public thinks the same? Could it be, perhaps, that people just don't trust scientists? Here's Dan Kahan. He's another cultural cognition researcher and a professor at Yale Law School.
Well, in fact, scientists are the most trusted people in our society. The Pew Foundation does research on this. This has been a consistent finding over time.
Okay, so there goes that theory. That explanation won't work for us then.
Correct.
All right, so maybe people just don't understand the science. Surveys have found that fewer than 30% of Americans are scientifically literate. Ellen Peters again.
People have the belief that the reason that people don't believe the risks of climate change are high enough is because they're not smart enough. They're not educated enough. They don't understand the facts like the scientists do. And we're really interested in that idea and whether that's really what was going on or whether something else might matter.
So Peters and Kahan started out their climate change study by testing people on their scientific literacy and numeracy, how well they knew math.
And the items are things like, it is the father's gene that decides whether the baby is a boy or a girl, true or false.
True.
So fairly simple.
Is it true?
Actually, I'm not even positive on that one. I think it's the it has to be the father's gene.
I'm putting my money on father true.
Father is true there, absolutely.
Okay.
Second question, antibiotics kill viruses as well as bacteria.
Negative.
True or false?
Negative.
That one is absolutely false.
You can see why they wanted to know how people did on these kind of questions before asking them about climate change.
Numeracy in general, what it should do is it should help you to better understand information, first of all. And that kind of comprehension is sort of a basic building block of good decisions across a variety of domains.
Right, right.
But numeracy should also do other things. It should also help you just simply process the information more systematically. It should, in general, help you to get to better decisions that are more in line with the facts.
All right. That makes perfect sense. But you have found something that kind of flies in the face of that, haven't you?
We have. It's the idea that people who are highly numerate and highly scientifically literate, they seem to actually rely on pre-existing beliefs, on these sort of underlying cultural cognitions they have about how the world should be structured, more than people who are less scientifically literate or less numerate.
So if I wanted to be wildly reductive, I might say that the more education a culture gets, the more likely we are to have intense polarization, at least among the educated classes. Is that right?
Based on our data, that's what it looks like. It's so interesting and so disturbing at the same time.
It is interesting, isn't it? I mean, Peters and Kahan found that high scientific literacy and numeracy were not correlated with a greater fear of climate change. Instead, the more you knew, the more likely you were to hold an extreme view in one direction or the other. That is, to be either very, very worried about the risks of climate change or to be almost not worried at all. In this case, more knowledge led to more extremism. Now, why on earth would that be? Dan Kahan has a theory. He thinks that our individual beliefs on hot-button issues like this have less to do with what we know than with who we know.
My activities as a consumer, my activities as a voter, they're just not consequential enough to count. But my views on climate change will have an impact on me in my life. If I go out of the studio here over to campus at Yale and I start telling people that climate change is a hoax, and these are colleagues of mine, the people in my community, that's going to have an impact on me. They're going to form a certain kind of view of me because of the significance of climate change in our society, probably a negative one. Now, if I live, in Sarah Palin's Alaska, or something, and I take the position that climate change is real, and I start saying that, I could have the same problem. My life won't go as well. People who are science literate are even better at figuring that out, even better at finding information that's going to help them form, maintain a view that's consistent with the one that's dominant within their cultural group.
So you're saying that if I believe that climate change is a very serious issue and I want to align my life with that belief, that it's actually more important that I align my life with that belief, not because of anything I can do, but because it helps me fit in better in my circle. There's more currency to my belief there. What about you? You're in New Haven, Connecticut, at Yale. I gather you haven't walked into a classroom and publicly declared that you believe climate change or global warming is a hoax, have you?
No, I haven't done that.
This makes sense, doesn't it? But it's also humbling. We like to think that we make up our minds about important issues based on our rational, unbiased assessment of the available facts. But the evidence assembled by Kahan and Peters shows that our beliefs, even about something as scientifically oriented as climate change, are driven by a psychological need to fit in. And so we create strategies for doing this. Here's my Freakonomics friend and co-author, Steve Levitt.
I think one of the issues with information gathering is that when people go to the trouble to learn about a topic, they tend not to learn about a topic in an open-minded way. They tend to seek out exactly those sources which will confirm what they'd like to believe in the first place. And so the more you learn about a topic, you tend to learn in a very particular way that tends to reinforce what you believed before you ever started.
Aha. So if you're already scared of something, you tend to read more about how scary it is. And if you're not worried, then you don't worry, right?
So if there's one thing that human beings are terrible at, it's assessing risk and knowing what to really fear versus the things we actually do fear. And the kind of things that tend to scare us are things that evolution has bred into us. So my wife is terrified of snakes, mice, flies, you know, butterflies, everything small that flies or that runs, she's terrified of. What are the chances that any of those are going to do her any harm in the modern world? Virtually nothing. I mean, the thing that you should be afraid of are French fries and double cheeseburgers and getting too much sun for skin cancer. Those are the kind of things that really end up killing us in the modern world.
Coming up, since we're so bad at figuring out what's really dangerous, let's bring in the professionals, shall we?
I'm Mr. Skeptic. Anything that can be analyzed critically and skeptically, that's what we do.
And a cautionary tale about siding with the conspiracy theorists.
I think somebody actually thought I was an alien myself.
From WNYC and APM, American Public Media, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
So, as Steve Levitt sees it, we seek out information that confirms our pre-existing biases, and we're congenitally bad at assessing risk. So, how are people supposed to figure out what to be afraid of? Here's Levitt again.
To know what to be afraid of, you need to go through an in-depth data collection process. You need to be properly informed. And people too busy, rightfully too busy, leading their lives instead of dwelling on what the exact, almost infinitesimal probability is that any particular thing will kill them. And so it's sensible for people to be uninformed, and it's sensible to rely on the media. It just turns out that the media is not a very good source of information.
If you really wanted to make sure that every one of your beliefs was worth holding, you'd have to spend so much time gathering primary data that you'd have no time for anything else in life. You'd practically have to become a professional skeptic. And that's not a job, is it?
I'm Mr. Skeptic. Anything that can be analyzed critically and skeptically, that's what we do. So anything from UFOs and alien abductions to Bigfoot and conspiracy theories, all the way up to things like global warming and climate change and autism and vaccinations, and we cover it all.
Michael Shermer, a professor at Claremont University, has a master's degree in experimental psychology and a PhD in the history of science. He's also the publisher of Skeptic Magazine, and he writes books. His latest is called The Believing Brain. Now, as a professional skeptic, I'm guessing a lot of people look at you or hear about a guy like you or read a book by you and think, oh, man, that's like the dream job. You know, people think, well, I'm a skeptic. I don't believe anything. So what do you have to do to be you, Michael?
Well, we actually do believe all sorts of things, and you have to have all sorts of beliefs just to get out of bed in the morning. And so the question then becomes, well, which of your host of beliefs are the ones that are really supported by evidence or questionable or probably not true? And which are those that we base on instinct and intuition, and which are we basing on, you know, solid evidence? And so that's where the rubber meets the road, is not do you believe something or not. Of course, we all believe all sorts of things. The question is, are they true, and what's the evidence, and what's the quality of the evidence?
Talk to me about how we end up believing what we believe in. I was going to say how we choose to believe what we believe in, but it sounds like it's not really a choice, right?
It isn't really a choice, no. Our brains are designed by evolution to constantly be forming connections, patterns, learning things about the environment. And all animals do it. You think A is connected to B, and sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't, but we just assume it is. So my thought experiment is, imagine you're a hominid on the plains of Africa 3.5 million years ago. Your name is Lucy. And you hear a rustle in the grass. Is it a dangerous predator, or is it just the wind? Well, if you think that the rustle in the grass is a dangerous predator and it turns out it's just the wind, you've made a type 1 error in cognition, a false positive. You thought A was connected to B, but it wasn't. But no big deal. That's a low-cost error to make. You just become a little more cautious and vigilant, but that's it. On the other hand, if you think the rustle in the grass is just the wind and it turns out it's a dangerous predator, you're lunch. Congratulations, you've just been given a Darwin Award for taking yourself out of the gene pool before reproducing. So we are the descendants of those who were most likely to find patterns that are real. And we tend to just believe all rustles in the grass are dangerous predators, just in case they are. And so that's the basis of superstition and magical thinking.
But then we get to something like climate change, which is theoretically an arena bounded entirely by science, right?
You would think so. I mean,
yeah, you would think so. So what do we find?
Either the Earth
actually
is getting warmer or it's not, right? I mean, it's just a data question. Well, because it also has ideological baggage connected to it, you know, left-wing versus right-wing politics. And so the data goes out the window. It's like, I don't know, whatever the data is, I don't know, but I'm going to be against it. Now, I can't just say, oh, I'm against it because my party is, or I just do what other people tell me. Nobody says that. What you do is you make the decision, I'm skeptical of that, or I don't believe it. And then you have to have arguments. So then you go in search of the argument.
It doesn't sound like it surprises you at all, then, that education, level of education, doesn't necessarily have a big impact on whether you're pro or con something, correct?
That's right. It doesn't. And giving smart people more information doesn't help. It actually just confuses things. It just gives them more opportunity to pick out the ones that support what they already believe. So being educated and intelligent, you're even better at picking out the confirming data to support your beliefs after the fact.
Let's talk now for a bit about conspiracy theories, which we're nibbling around the edges of. How would you describe, if you can, generalize the type of person who's most likely to engage in a conspiracy theory?
Their pattern-seeking module is just wide open. The net has, you know, is indiscriminatory. They think everything's a pattern. If you think everything's a pattern, then you're kind of a nut.
I suppose I'm best known for having had a job at the government where my duties were investigating UFOs.
That's Nick Pope. Until 2006, he worked for the British Ministry of Defense. And in the early 90s, he headed up the office that handled reports of UFO sightings.
Flying saucer sightings, as they were called then.
His job was to figure out if any of these sightings had merit, and if, perhaps, there were extraterrestrial visitors.
To satisfy ourselves that there was no threat to the defense of the UK.
Pope came into the job as a skeptic, but Some UFO reports, especially from pilots and police officers, got him wondering if perhaps we were being visited by aliens. Now, mind you, there was no hardcore confirmatory evidence, but Pope started talking in the media about the possibilities.
You say that you believe with 99% certainty that we're not alone. So tell us what you've discovered.
Well, I think it's inconceivable in this infinite universe that we're alone. Mm-hmm. And then that begs the question, if we're not alone, are we being visited? It's a related question.
When I started speaking out on this issue, I think some people in the UFO community thought that I might be some sort of standard bearer for them.
Meaning one of them?
Yes, absolutely, that I could be a spokesperson for the movement. Of course, I had the huge advantage that whilst everyone else had done this as a hobby, I'd done it as a job.
Did that make you a bit of a hero in the UFO community?
It did, and a lot of people still hold that view. They want me to come out and say, yes, it's all real, and yes, I was part of a cover-up. Their fantasy is what they call disclosure, with a capital D, as if there's going to be some magical parting of the curtains and a moment where a crashed spaceship is revealed for all the world to see. And because I say, you know what, I don't think that spaceship exists. So, in a sense, I managed to upset everyone. I go too far for a lot of the skeptics by being open to the possibility, but I don't go far enough for the believers, particularly the conspiracy theorists. And I get called things like shill, and that's one of the more polite things I've been called.
Yeah, I've looked at some of the comments on YouTube from a speech you gave. I'll read you a bit of it. We'll have to employ our bleeping technician later. Nick Pope, what a... spastic. He works, he quote, works for the government. Why else is he constantly on every bloody UFO program on every channel? He talks enough bull to keep the UFO nutters happy while never actually saying anything of importance. Let's unpack that one a little bit.
Yeah, shall we, Mr. Pope? Yes.
It says you quote work for the government. Do you still work for the government?
No, I don't. This is in itself one of the great conspiracy theories, that in 2006 I didn't really leave. I just went under deep cover, and that they're passing me wads of banknotes in a brown paper bag or something.
But here's my favorite. There's one claim on a UFO blog that you, Nick Pope, have been abducted by aliens yourself and now lie about it.
Well, yes, I've heard that one. I've even seen one, which I think you might have missed. I think somebody actually thought I was an alien myself.
Ah, that would explain a lot, wouldn't it? Nick Pope discovered a sad truth. The more transparent he tried to be, the more information he released about himself and his work, the more worked up his attackers became. They took facts that would plainly seem to work in his favor, and they somehow made these facts fit their conspiracies instead. But before we judge, consider how good we all are at deciding first what we want to believe and then finding evidence for it. So what's the solution? What can we do to keep ourselves headed down the road, albeit slowly and clumsily, toward a more rational, reasoned civilization? Here's Ellen Peters again from the Cultural Cognition Project. So I guess the depressing conclusion one might reach from hearing you speak is that ideology trumps rationalism?
I think that we are seeing some evidence for that in this study, but I don't think that that has to be the final answer. I think that policymakers, communicators, need to start paying attention to some of these cues that deepen cultural polarization. So, for example, telling the other side that they're scientifically inept, probably a bad idea. Probably not the best way to continue people coming together on what the basic science really does say. Or coming up only with solutions that are antagonistic to one side. And you know it if you are listening to them, that those are just antagonistic solutions. Again, probably not the best idea. It's a sign or a signal that we're not listening maybe as well to beliefs on the other side.
Dan Kahan agrees that whatever the solution, none of us are able to go it alone.
What's clear is that our ability to acquire knowledge is linked up with our ability to figure out whom to trust about what. And ordinary people have to do that in making sense of the kinds of challenges that they face. But the amount that we know far exceeds the amount that any one of us is able to establish through our own efforts. Maybe you know that the motto for the Royal Society is nullia in verba, which means don't take anybody's word for it. And it's kind of admirable and charming, but obviously false.
Not very practical, is it?
Can't be right. I mean, what would I do? I would say, you know, don't tell me what Newton said in the Principia. I'm going to try to figure out how gravity works on my own.
And speaking of Isaac Newton, you remember what Stephen Greenspan told us earlier? How Newton was suckered into this terrible investment? Well, it's heartening to learn that even Newton, the scientific sage, was able to acknowledge the flaws in his own thinking, the shortcomings in his own thinking. And he left behind some advice that might be helpful for us all. He wrote, "To explain all nature is too difficult a task for any one man or even for any one age. 'Tis much better to do a little with certainty and leave the rest for others that come after you than to explain all things by conjecture without making sure of anything." In other words, don't get too cocky.
Freakonomics Radio is produced by WNYC, APM, American Public Media, and Dubner Productions. This episode was produced by Catherine Wells. Our staff includes Susie Lechtenberg, Diana Wynn, Bere Lamb, Colin Campbell, and Chris Bannon. Our interns are Ian Chant and Jacob Bastian. David Herman is our engineer. Special thanks to John Delore. If you want more Freakonomics Radio, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or go to Freakonomics.com. where you'll find lots of radio, a blog, the books, and more.
Hey, podcast listeners. We're putting together another FAQ episode soon. That's Frequently Asked Questions. So if you've got a burning question you want us to answer, go to our website. It's freakonomics.com/radio and click the talk back box on the right hand side. And if you're not careful, you just might hear your question on the radio someday.
Earth, sky.
What we expect is that the world will behave itself. As we turn up CO2, the world will get warmer, but we'll sort of know what's coming and we'll be able to make wise decisions in time about whether to slow down the rise in CO2 and stop it or whether to adapt to the changes that come. What we're a little worried about is that we do know from history, from our ice cores, and from other records, that occasionally the climate is not well behaved.
You're listening to Richard Alley, a geologist at Penn State and winner of a 2011 Heinz Award. For the past several decades, Alley has been studying ice cores, samples from the accumulation of snow and ice laid down over thousands of years in Greenland and Antarctica. Alley did groundbreaking work in science when he helped extract a 2-mile-long ice core from Greenland in the early 1990s, which shows that Earth's climate changed abruptly in the past. With more of the greenhouse gas CO2 added each year to Earth's atmosphere, Dr. Alley is worried that abrupt climate change could happen again. Alley spoke with Earth Sky's Beth Lebwohl.
Dr. Alley, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure.
So you helped enhance scientists' understanding of climate change by suggesting that it could happen quickly rather than slowly. Tell us more.
Yeah, our community has been looking at how fast climate could change. And a lot of what we do is to look at the history of climate. If it happened, it might happen again. And so I was part of big projects that have gone to Greenland and Antarctica to look at ice cores. Snow on the big ice sheets piles up summer, winter, summer, winter, summer, winter. And in the snow are indications of how much fell, how dirty the air was,
what cosmic rays were coming down and how much space dust and other things like that, and indications of temperature. When we look at those histories, what we find is that usually the climate has been well-behaved. If you give it a little more sun or a little more CO2, it gets a little warmer. Occasionally, though, you give it a little more something, and something really weird happens. The climate will jump to a new state in as little as a few years.
Some of your landmark scientific work about abrupt climate change was based on data you acquired from a 2-mile-long ice core pulled from Greenland in the 1990s. So tell us about that.
We can actually count down through the years of history, and we start at the present and start going back. In that snow, there are indications of how much it was accumulating at a time, what the temperature was in Greenland, how much dust was blowing through the air, and a number of other things. And so a whole bunch of us counted back through history, and we got more than 10,000 years back without seeing very large or very fast changes, and then we hit sort of a cliff. And in a very few years, maybe 10, maybe fewer, we see change in everything that was measured in the core, and very large changes. Temperature changes in Greenland were 15 degrees Fahrenheit or more. Snowfall changed by a factor of 2. Dust in the air changed, and a number of other things changed as well.
Okay, so when was that? What caused it? And how does that apply to today? How did it revise, let's say, climate change theory?
Yes, so it was about 11,500 years ago that this really big change happened, and then there were many more similar ones older than that. It was linked to changes in the way that the ocean circulated and changes in sea ice, whether the ocean froze in the winter around Greenland or not. It's something that we're watching carefully for the future. We don't think it's going to happen in the future, but we're not positive. If we melt a lot of Greenland's ice fairly fast, it will make the North Atlantic fresher because of the fresh water coming off Greenland, and that may influence the way the ocean circulates, and that in turn could have large and abrupt changes.
Okay, and of course we're talking about Greenland's ice sheet, which could melt as a consequence of global warming. Is that correct?
That is correct. So Greenland has enough ice on it that if it all melted from warming, it would raise the sea level around the world an average of about 23 feet.
I think the one thing that's unclear to me is best-case scenario versus worst-case scenario with regard to climate. What would climate look like if it got real bad because of the way, because of what we're doing to Earth? And what would it look like if it just sort of behaved itself?
Right. So worst-case scenarios would be things such as changing ocean circulation in a way that made it dry in the monsoon belts, in places where a couple of billion people are expecting on the rain to water their crops. We know these abrupt changes in the North Atlantic were accompanied by drought in monsoonal regions. And so if we were to trigger something in the North Atlantic, it might in turn trigger changes in the monsoon. We're fairly confident that the Antarctic and Greenland ice sheets will stay where they are and melt fairly slowly. But if we were to dump an ice sheet in the ocean rapidly, you could have very rapid sea level rise. We don't expect any of those, but they are the sort of drunk drivers in the climate system that we can't totally exclude the possibility that they would happen.
Given that we need to have some insurance against the possibility of a very abrupt and severe climate change, what does that insurance look like?
Less emissions of carbon dioxide, basically. So try not to change the climate as rapidly would be one way to buy insurance. The other thing you look at is trying to build society to be a little more flexible, a little more resilient. If you're planning how high to build the wall around the city to keep the flood out, maybe you build it a little higher just in case. If you're planning to what area is likely to be flooded or hit droughts or so on, you put a little cushion in the way you do things so that if things turn out to be a little worse than we expected in the future, we have some ability to deal with it.
Is it naive to be optimistic about Earth's future? And also, what's the most important thing you'd like to tell EarthSky's global audience about climate change.
It is not naive to be optimistic about the future. The amount of energy that you use to run you and your brain and all your thinking is about the same as the amount of energy that's used by an old 100-watt Edison light bulb burning continuously. If we put our brain power to work, what we need is supplied by the planet. It's just a matter of getting what we want out of what we use. We can do this. We can make this energy. We can make sustainability. We can grow the food. We can make sure that people's kids survive. We can make sure that people have something good to do. We can reach a sustainable future.
You've been listening to Richard Alley, a geologist at Penn State and winner of a 2011 Heinz Award. For this and other free science interview podcasts, visit the subscribe page at earthsky.org. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Earth, Sky.
The one piece of the puzzle that I think we do understand well is that as the atmosphere warms, it can hold more water, and thus the water in the atmosphere increases with warming.
You're listening to Frank Wentz, director of the company Remote Sensing Systems in Santa Rosa, California, and this is Earth Sky's Clear Voices for Science. Predicting how our warming climate will change rainfall patterns around the world is extremely complicated, said Wentz. He uses satellites to measure changes in water in Earth's atmosphere over decades, not just the rain and clouds you can see, but the invisible vapor that comprises 99% of the water in our atmosphere. Wentz talked with Earth Sky's Jorge Salazar about the complex puzzle of how climate change affects rainfall.
Mr. Wentz, welcome to Earth Sky's Clear Voices for Science.
It's nice to be here.
Now, what are the most important elements that go into studying the connection of greenhouse gases that warm the planet and changes to rainfall patterns? And in other words, in answering the question of your study of how much more rain will global warming bring?
Well, the one piece of the puzzle that I think we do understand well is that as the atmosphere warms, it can hold more water, and thus the water in the atmosphere increases with warming. Now, the more difficult question is how much of this additional water is going to turn into rain. If there were no changes in the motion of the air and atmospheric circulation, then the rain would increase at the same rate as the total water, which we think we know fairly well to be about 7% per degree warming. However, most climate models predict that the atmospheric circulation slows down. The overturn of the atmosphere doesn't occur as quickly. And thus what you end up with is a more wet but stagnant atmosphere. And according to the climate models, the rain is going to increase at a considerably slower rate, about one-third of what the total water in the atmosphere increases by. But that said, the climate models are trying to model a very complicated process, but my focus really is on the satellite measurements themselves rather than trying to theoretically model the Earth's response to various forcings like increasing greenhouse gases, aerosols, and varying solar radiation.
What did you mean by this moisture that is this added moisture that's going into the atmosphere?
Well, you just sort of go over it again. It's sort of like in the tropics. When you go in the tropics, the air is very warm, and you can actually feel the increased humidity. So we all agree, and the scientists and the measurements all agree in the sense that we really see this increased moisture in the atmosphere as the air warms. But just because there's more water in the atmosphere doesn't necessarily mean there's going to be that much more rain, because the rainfall is also determined by the air circulation. It's sort of like a conveyor belt. And even though the packets on the conveyor belt contain more water, if the conveyor belt slows down, then there'll be less rain.
And this this time series that you referred to, you're talking about measurements made by satellites, right?
That's right. There's AQUA. Flies a microwave radiometer called AMSR-E. And the way this radiometer works is it actually listens to the natural emission of microwaves from the Earth. And by measuring these microwaves, you can very accurately measure water vapor in the atmosphere. And I didn't say it, but almost all the water in the atmosphere, 99% of the water in the atmosphere, is water vapor. It's invisible. You don't see it when you look up at the sky. You look up the sky, you see clouds and rain. But the clouds and rain are only about 1% of the total water. Almost all the water is in terms of this vapor. And the microwaves can measure the vapor very, very well, very precisely. We use about 10 different satellites, and we piece them all together starting back in the 1980s until today to generate these 25 and 30-year time series of water vapor and rainfall.
And you mentioned that AQUA is just one of a whole fleet of instruments out there in space right now that are looking at what's happening to changes on Earth. How do the measurements by AQUA fit into the larger picture of studying the effects of global warming on precipitation?
Because there's such a close relationship between warming and the increase in water, by measuring the increase in water, you can then determine warming. And actually, surprisingly, as it turns out, that the measurement of water is more accurate than direct measurements of temperature. It's what engineers call a signal-to-noise ratio. And the signal-to-noise ratio for the water measurement is about 7 times higher than the signal-to-noise ratio of the direct temperature measurement that other satellites measure. So we're able to get a more accurate measure of global warming by using the microwave instruments that are on AQUA and also on other satellites. And in fact, back in the 90s, some of the other satellites that measure temperature seemed to suggest that there was no warming. And we looked at the microwave measurements of water and found that the water in the atmosphere was increasing at a good rate, which was in complete disagreement with the direct temperature measurements. And we later found that the direct temperature measurements were flawed in the way they were processed, and that was then later corrected. But the measurement of water was one of the first indications that the atmosphere was indeed warming at a fairly hefty rate.
Now, I believe that you may be referring to your study that came out a few years ago and published in the journal Science that looked at the data from the special sensor microwave imager that flies aboard Navy, I believe it's Navy satellites.
Yeah, it's a defense satellite, and that's right. That the first one of those SSMIs was flown in 1987, and we published a paper sometime, I think it was 1998, 1999, where we pieced together about 20 years of or 15 years, I guess, at that point, of that instrument. And it definitely showed that there was an appreciable moistening of the planet. And that flew right in the face of some other analyses that were saying that the temperature of the atmosphere was not increasing. And so that put the spotlight on the temperature data. And looking at that more carefully, we found a basic flaw in the way that the temperature data had been processed. And once that flaw was corrected, then both the temperature and the increasing moisture agreed as the theory predicts. And that theory is called Clausius-Clapeyron, and it's basically warm air holds more water, and every degree the air increases, it can hold 7% more water.
You've written that that the changes in rainfall across the globe may be one of the most serious risks from climate change. Tell us more about what you meant by that.
Well, yeah, I think it's sort of obvious. I mean, you have world food production, and our world food production, you know, depends critically on rainfall. And we need to know where it will rain and how much rain there is going to be. And if these rain patterns begin to change and intensify, then we need to adapt quickly. We need to adapt our agriculture and crop selections and to match with the new rain patterns. And also, there's some very heavily populated regions on the planet, such as Bangladesh, that are already plagued with flooding. And a significant increase in rainfall in these areas would really cause some problems.
What are some of the important highlights that you would want people to walk away with in thinking about this instrument on AQUA as it's looking at precipitation in the atmosphere?
Well, Aqua is the amp series is an incredible instrument. It has been able to tell us a lot about precipitation patterns. It went up in 2002, so we now have about 9 years of data. It's very accurate. The Japanese built a very nice instrument for us. But besides this precipitation, it's provided through cloud sea surface temperature. That's the ability to actually measure the temperature of the ocean through clouds, winds on the ocean, snow cover. It's just been a real boon for scientists and climate studies. And we're also looking forward to a continuation. There's a second AMPSR that the Japanese are going to be launching on their GCOM-W satellite, and that's scheduled to be launched later this year. And then NASA is putting another follow-on mission called the Global Precipitation Mission, which is scheduled for launch in 2013, which will continue the Aqua AMPSR legacy.
What's the most important thing you want people today to know about global warming and rainfall?
Okay. Well, maybe for your audience, I don't need to say this, but I'll say it anyway, and that is that global warming is real. It's not a hoax. However, one should not expect a perfectly steady increase in temperature. Now, we've already seen in the 1990s that there was a relatively large amount of warming and moistening, while this last decade, 2000-2010, the warming trends have decreased some. But this type of variability is to be expected. But having said that, I think we also have to acknowledge that the Earth is an extremely complex system to predict, and as I said, particularly with respect to rainfall as opposed to simply predicting overall warming. And just the knowledge that we can expect a change should help us in planning. We sort of have to, you know, plan to be adaptive and be ready to, change agricultural plans as we see these things play out.
You've been listening to Frank Wentz, director of the company Remote Sensing Systems in Santa Rosa, California. To subscribe to this and other free science interview podcasts, visit the subscribe page at earthsky.org. Our thanks today to NASA's Aqua mission, improving our knowledge of our home planet through satellite observations. I'm Deborah Bird. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
You are listening to WHF.